Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Hank.
It's reluctant.
You were reluctant.
Yes.
How are you today?
I'm okay. How are you doing?
I am feeling wonderful. I am always excited when we have a lofty topic to cover.
You have a lofty topic and a room full of guests, so that's exciting too.
Yeah, it really
is. I don't need to chit-chat so much with you.
Right. You're a bit off the hook. But yeah, I like when we have something that's even a little out of my comfort zone, maybe a little out of my expertise, which today definitely is. But what inspired kind of today's topic was a conversation that I had with my students. I like to talk about this history of the feminist movements and the three waves and how it relates to how our family structures changed over the decades and the generations based on what happened with the feminist movements. And so I was talking about the suffragist movement, which was the movement for women to earn the right to vote. And the first thing that concerned me was how few of my students actually knew what I was talking about or had had any historical context for the suffragist movement. I know there's a lot of history to cover, and I know there's a lot of things that we're trying to teach our children, but this feels like such a significant part of our human history. I was dismayed that how few of the students knew anything about any of the feminist movements, first, second, or third wave. But the thing that stood out for me also is how slowly real significant social change happens. That when I said, you know, the first meeting of the Women's Rights Convention was in 1848, and yet we didn't have the 19th Amendment passed till 1920, that was 72 years that generations of women had to continuously stay on the path of their mission to get the right to vote, personhood for women. And it wasn't, you know, just a straight line either. There were forward movements and there was pushback and there were changes in political parties and governments and changes in the economic structure. I mean, this resolve, the steady resolve to get this passed was amazing. That the determination could be passed on from one generation to the next. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, one of the originators of the Women's Rights Convention, her daughter was actually there at the signing. But of the 100 women and men who originally signed the Declaration of Sentiments at the Women's Rights Convention, which is a whole other show, but of the 100, only one person lived to see the 19th Amendment passed. And so I was thinking about how quickly things come up now with social media, like the hashtag MeToo movement. And it seems like it's a thing again that we have women's rights on the forefront and we're talking about sexual assault and misconduct and women having access in the workplace. Side note, a lot of women thought that this had already been taken care of years and years ago and were surprised to find out that really without the ERA, we don't have any protection under the law. We just have a lot of laws that aren't enforced. But we're still talking about some of those fundamental issues that women have been grappling with since 1848 and 1920 and 1970, that these things kind of go on and haven't, don't seem to have changed. But at the same time, we've made significant changes that we kind of take for granted, like the awareness. But the concern is that something like the hashtag MeToo comes on with a fury and gets a lot of media attention, but will it sustain? You know, will that resolve to keep talking about changes in gender issues, changes in how we raise young men and young women, will that sustain? Well, do we have the fortitude? Because I think part of the reason that the suffragist movement and early civil rights movements were able to retain their strength was because there wasn't the shiny objects. There wasn't so much social media and distractions and Netflix and different activities that people could kind of wander off to. That these things were in the forefront day in and day out. And it was in the news cycle day in and day out. And there weren't 2,500 different news sources. And so part of me wonders if we can have any sort of sustained social change action at this time with so many distractions.
Well, with the Me Too movement, I mean, that's just come through like a freight train. I mean, that's huge. And obviously, there's big names involved, you know, people that we thought were good people that turned out not to be. What's kind of taken a back seat, and I thought this was primarily behind us, was the unequal pay. You know, I thought that was 20 years ago that had been resolved, but apparently women are still getting paid less than men, and that's ridiculous.
And that's what I'm saying, that these changes, these gains are slow and small and steady, but we go forward and we go back. And so that was one piece of what inspired today. The other piece was an email I got from a teacher at New Tech High School talking about an exceptional young student that she has, and that he has worked with her to organize a Take a Knee rally in San Luis Obispo, and they would like to come and talk about the Take a Knee rally and the Take a Knee movement and this young man's passion for social justice. And I said, that's the kind of person that I want to talk about, those ordinary people doing extraordinary things and kind of that hope for the future that there are young people willing to take up the cause that has been around for a long time. And so because we are entering into February, which is Black History Month, I thought it was a good time to kind of talk about other long, slow changes that happen. And that's the civil rights of African Americans in society. And if you look at the suffragist movement that started in 1848, and here we are in 2018, the first Civil Rights Act was actually passed in 1866 during the Reconstruction phase, and then was written again in 57 and 64 and 68. And we keep having these new iterations of the Civil Rights Act and making small changes, significant changes, and then steps backwards, and small changes and step backwards. And so if we're wondering how we're going to sustain the energy, one of my guests today is that next generation that I was excited to talk about, and what this looks like for young African-Americans, children of color, families, you know, that have long since not been recognized in our community. There's a lot of energy to change status in society. And then another conversation I had with my good friend, Krissa, who I've known for 20-something years. I was talking about this, and this young man I was going to have come on the show, and she said, oh, you need to talk to Pop-Pop, my father-in-law. He is an amazing man. He grew up in South Georgia. He went through in desegregation of schools. He served in the military. He moved to California and worked as a counselor in the Paso Robles Youth Authority, and his father helped to co-write the 1964 Civil Rights Act with President Johnson. I said, well, then we need to see Pop-Pop. So today I'm really excited to have in the studio Randall Thomas, or Pop-Pop, but I guess we'll stick with Randall today, and Keanu Liddell. Keanu.
That's all right.
Keanu Liddell. And I'm going to kind of hand over the conversation to them for the most part today to get two generational perspectives on what's happening with civil rights and the African-American community looking back and moving forward. And I'll probably open up the phone lines as well, because I'm sure there's many people who have thoughts and questions or comments they'd like to make about where we are today as far as freedom and equality and opportunities. Our number is 805-781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. You can be part of the conversation by giving us a call later on in the show. You can also join us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or check out our website, thereluctanttherapist.com. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. And if you'd like to podcast the show, just go to Apple Podcasts, look for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and hit subscribe, and all the shows will be uploaded so you can listen at your convenience. So without further ado, I look forward to this conversation and hope you'll hang around and join us. Hold on. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. And I am happy to have in the studio two guests today to talk about, from their generational perspectives, what's happening with civil rights and the cause of African Americans and all people of color at this moment in history, and as we step into February and Black History Month. My first guest is Randall Thomas, and as I mentioned before, he grew up in Southern Georgia as a military veteran, worked as a counselor, as a retired counselor with the Paso Robles Youth Authority, and is the son of a civil rights activist who helped to co-write the 1964 Civil Rights Act with President Johnson. He was called up twice for counsel. Randall's father,
Curtis
Thomas, was also honored by their hometown, Thomasville, for his activities during the civil rights movement. My other guest is Keanu Lede. Keanu is a senior at New Tech High School in Napomo and is very passionate about social justice and has worked with his teacher, Dara. Is she your high school teacher?
Yeah, she taught my...
your history teacher?
Yeah, one of my math classes, actually, she taught. And then one of our passion advisories is Social Justice League. So she introduced me to that idea, and I've been getting really involved.
So part of the Social Justice League is a partnership with the San Luis Obispo County NAACP and putting on a Take a Knee rally this Saturday from 11 to 2:30 in Mission Plaza. And the theme is Stand Up for America, Take a Knee for Equality and Justice for All. So I'm looking forward to hearing both of your perspectives. But let's start with Randall. I gave a little overview of your childhood, but what was it like growing up the son of a civil rights activist?
Well, it was actually pretty intense at times. We had to go to the quote-unquote white school. The first year was available to us because he, being the civil rights activist, his statement was, well, how can I get other people to send their children if I don't send mine? So that's kind of how we ended up in that situation.
And what year was this?
This was 1966.
So again, how slow change comes, because Brown versus Board of Education was passed in 1954. And then we started desegregating the schools after 57 with a little nudge from the federal government saying you need to do this. But it wasn't until much later then that you're in, this was in South Georgia.
Thomasville, Georgia, yeah.
And so what were you going into high school then?
Seventh grade.
Mm-hmm. So how was the, and you weren't the first school to desegregate in your area, I would imagine.
Yes.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, right.
All right, so what was the reception like as a seventh grader?
Well, it wasn't quite a warm reception. It was, there were policemen involved and escorting us in, you know, to class and things. But that didn't last long. Thomasville was known as a leader in civil rights and equal rights in that area, in South Georgia. So it was difficult at first. And as a matter of fact, out of 1,200 students, I was the only black in my class except for homeroom, and there was one other. So it was 40 initial African-American students that attended the school the first year.
And then did you find that the reception and the, you know, was there a community that started to develop? Did things start to integrate as was hoped? I mean, did it feel?
Well, yes. Each year, more and more students of color came over to now my high school, Thomasville High. The black high school was Douglas. And see, I felt I was looking forward to being in the Douglas High School band. Because
so that was something you had looked forward to as a kid.
And then in the seventh grade, I got sent to Thomasville High. So there goes my Douglas. but it was the experience of a lifetime. It made me who I am today. It gave me a good foundation for knowing people.
Did you play in the band then for Thomasville or after?
Okay, yes, so I did. And well, since Thomasville was the first school in the area, when we participated in at the football game halftime, a lot of times we were heckled and things were thrown at us, and you know. And but Thomasville. The older students would put us in the middle and encircle us to protect us. So, like I said, it showed me that people are good no matter what color they are.
And so being the son of a civil rights activist, I would imagine there was some pressure on you to be well-behaved.
Yes, it was. Yeah, I didn't have a very exciting growing up. You know, I had to watch things I said, places I visited, things of that nature. And we didn't have a whole lot of money. So there were reasons that we couldn't screw up because all eyes were on us, and my dad was doing some important stuff.
And how did your dad get involved in the movement?
Well, a couple of things happened, and there was no justice. So they decided that they were going to start the NAACP in South Georgia. And they went and got lawyers, and there was an old sharecropper that had killed a white man in his home. The man came in into his home and started physically beating him, and so he asked the guy to stop, and when he fell through the door of his bedroom, that's where he kept his shotgun, and he killed him. So that was a big trial, and he was acquitted. It was self-defense, and that was a monumental in South Georgia. Oh, yeah. So that was one of the things that my father got involved in.
And so when he moved into the social justice place, I would imagine he still had to have his day job. Mm-hmm. And what did he do to make a living?
Well, he started out doing working in a laundry at the hospital, and then he went to night school and got his GED after the military. And after that, he started to work for the state of Georgia, initially as a fire marshal. Was a state fire marshal, and he traveled a lot throughout the state. And from there, he went to the Department of Employment. He was a employment guy. He helped people get jobs. And so this NAACP was kind of his night job. Mm-hmm. So, and he was also a barber, so he had a lot of irons in the fire. But he maintained it, and I'm very proud of
him. And so when the NAACP started in Thomasville, was there pushback, you know, from mm-hmm. the rest of the community to have this organization come to town and start taking?
Right. Well, the Ku Klux Klan actually called and threatened our family several times. And my father would send us to my grandmother's, and he would call friends over, and they would circle the block with, you know, shotguns and rifles and waiting for them to show up. Remember once he said, well, my address is 303 West Jurger, and I'll be right here. So come on.
So he's a pretty fearless guy.
Right. And because I was terrified of the fact that, you know, I could lose my life or he could lose his. So, yeah, it was trying times, but as I said, I'm still here, and we made it through.
And so when your dad was part of, you know, helping to write the Civil Rights Act, the original Civil Rights Act of 1964, and going up and meeting President Johnson, was he marching with Martin Luther King? Did he do the Selma to Montgomery march? Was he?
Yes, he did several of those. I tried to get to go to the Selma one, but to no avail, I couldn't. But there were other marches and things that I got to participate in. And one was I attended a KKK rally with my father and his friends to show that they weren't afraid. And I was afraid as I waited in the car going, I don't want to be here. He says, well, you're here now. You're going to have to wait till we leave. So that was That was one of those hair-raising experiences when you see this big cross burning and listening to all the hatred, you know, being spilled. It was, I got goosebumps just now thinking about it.
Those memories don't fade easily.
No, they don't.
And so you didn't stay in South Georgia. You left to go into the military. And what was that?
Well, I went off to college in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Do you go to University of Tennessee?
No, Knoxville College, okay. UNCF College.
Okay.
For those of you that don't know, that's a United Negro College Fund kind of school. So I was in the middle of my sophomore year when I was drafted by the U.S. Army to go to Vietnam. Although Vietnam was tailing off, I still got drafted. And that was in 1972 and 73, January, I was in the military.
And so do you served your 4 years?
Three.
3 years. Mm-hmm. And then were you able to go back and return to school, or did you go off on other adventures?
Well, I went back to Thomasville from here, from California, and I spent about a year there. I went to University of Georgia Extension. I worked as a radio announcer, a couple of different jobs, and then I came back out here in 1977.
1977.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then you worked as a counselor for
the Youth Authority.
Mm-hmm. And so what drew you to that work?
Well, for one thing, the retirement, the benefits, and the money that they paid. I had been a purchasing manager for a small outfit in San Luis called Montadoro Whitney, who did flow meters and things of that nature. And so when they went public, they replaced all the management, and I was the last one to go. So I went to the unemployment office, and while I was there filling out paperwork, I looked at the board for jobs, and there it was. The Youth Authority, Group Supervisor, or Department of Corrections Officer. So I applied to both. And the Department of Corrections called me three times to go to work, and I chose to wait for the Youth Authority. I thought I would be more effective there.
Mm-hmm. If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And my guests today are Randall Thomas and Keanu Lede. I don't know why I can't get your name just in one
swoop. It's all right.
Keanu Lede, who we're going to spend a couple of minutes getting to know as well. So, Keanu, you as a senior in high school found yourself really involved in social justice. And tell us a little bit about what got you involved in and about the Take a Knee rally that you're putting together.
Yeah. So last year, when our new president was elected, I think the country saw like this really huge divide come back. I think we had spent decades kind of fighting for social justice, and then we have this new president that kind of makes us walk back, and now we're kind of in a position not exactly the same but pretty similar as what Randall was going through. So my teacher, Dares to Panic, we have this thing called Passion Advisory, where some of the students get involved in things that they're really interested in. So we have like computer science, but one of them was Social Justice League. She got us partners with the NAACP and SLO, and we put together this Take a Knee rally, where basically we're trying to get this message across where we need to ensure political, educational, social, and economic equality, regardless of race, sex, gender, or religious beliefs. And so that'll take place on February 3rd, this Super Bowl Saturday. We'll have a lot of speakers. I'll be one of those. I'll be talking about, you know, youth empowerment and what the system can do to allow the younger people in this country more opportunities for them to really speak out and talk about their truth.
Right, yeah. To take their place.
Exactly. So I was really glad that I was one of the students to be given the opportunity to talk about, you know, my experiences growing up and what changes can be made to better the students of kids who grew up like me. And February 3rd, 11 to 2:30 at the Slow Mission Plaza. We'll have a lot of speakers like the San Luis Obispo mayor and the chief of police and myself. And you'll get to go and learn about, you know, a lot of the things that are happening right now and what the system can do for students and for adults who are struggling.
Well, then we talk, it's called the Take a Knee Rally, and there's been some controversy around even the term Take a Knee. So what does that mean to you?
Well, it took place, I can't remember the exact year, but Colin Kaepernick, the former...
Last football season.
Yes. They take a knee during the national anthem, mm-hmm. and I think the negative connotation comes from the timing of when we take a knee. So the national anthem, when you take a knee there, I think people take it as a disrespect to the country. But I think that was purposeful. I think that when you talk about social justice and the things that you want to see change, you have to do it at times when people become uncomfortable. And so we take that now to the day before the Super Bowl happens, one of the biggest days in the country. Everybody's watching mm-hmm. football. But to me, it just means you are standing up for America. So this title, Stand Up for America, Take a Knee for Social Justice and Equality for All. Mm-hmm. That's where you do this one small thing, but there's a large group of people taking a knee. And so when you have these people gathering around this one idea, that's where real change happens. So I'm really excited to see, you know, people come out and support this Take a Knee rally, not as negative disrespect the country, but this is what you're doing to see real change happen in the country.
And so what is the change that we're looking for? Like, where do you think we are in this continuum of civil rights for all? Starting from Randall's experience, you know, he had to go through the desegregation of schools. You didn't have to experience that. So talk a bit about what your experience has been growing up and where you feel like your rights have been violated or you needed to stand up and take a stand.
Yeah. Growing up, it wasn't necessarily the race issue that I had. It was more economic, socioeconomic, it was more circumstantial. So I don't think that the issue with racism is natural for people to have. I think that you have to be taught that. And so generations from like Randall's times, I think that has really transcended into now racism happens in a different form. So for me, it was economic. A lot of the racism.
So you felt more disengaged because of your socioeconomic status.
Yeah.
Rather than your background.
Yeah. So, you know, I found myself fighting a lot harder than a lot of other people had to fight. Getting involved now, I've built up this reputation that people really respect me for. And it didn't come easily. There's a lot of people, people from other races are privileged enough to go out and have the opportunity to speak at an event like this. But me, I had to build up the respect and reputation for me to be allowed to speak at an event like this.
So what's a little of your background? Where did you grow up?
I was born in Clovis, right next to Fresno. Growing up, it was economically challenging. I grew up, now we have 10 siblings. I have 10 siblings.
Where are you in the...
I'm the second oldest.
Okay.
Yeah.
A lot of responsibility.
Yes, a lot of responsibility. Wealth. There's no wealth in my family. Okay. Economically, it was really troubling. We bounced around a lot. I've lived in homeless shelters, women's shelters. I was a victim to domestic violence when I was younger, for about 8 years. That's when we started getting really involved in like government funded programs. So these programs kind of helped my mom get off of the ground when she had left this, you know, the abuser that was involved in our family. But again, I think my mom had to fight a lot harder because she was put in this position of all of these people around here kind of bringing her really, they were bringing her down. Mm-hmm. And so she had a fight and we all had a fight. And, you know, that whole idea of family is what really kept us together and what really got us through tough times.
This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guests today are Randall Thomas and Keanu Lide. And we're talking about where are we on the road toward equality for all in America? How far have we come since 1964 and here in 2018 with the Take a Knee rally coming up on Saturday? And we'll open up the phone lines in a moment to take your calls, thoughts, or comments to 805-781-3875. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back to take your calls and to continue this conversation.
People get ready, there's a train a coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get
So people get ready for the train to Jordan, picking up passengers coast to coast. Faith is the key, open the doors and boom.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875 as we continue our conversation about gains that we've made, how slowly those gains can be made when you're looking at social change and social justice. In particular, we're talking about a Take a Knee rally sponsored by the San Luis Obispo County NAACP this Saturday in Mission Plaza. And one of my guests, Keanu Lede, is one of the keynote speakers. He's a high school senior from New Tech High School, and he'll be talking about his perspective on social justice and where we are today. My other guest is Randall Thomas, and he is a retired military veteran and also counselor for the Paso Robles Youth Authority, and also the son of a civil rights activist. And so I invited Randall to talk about his experiences because I was just curious to know from two different generations. Randall, when you hear Keanu talking about what he sees as change or what needs to happen, what do you see? How far have we come, or have we come anywhere since you were his age?
Well, we have come a very long way, and we still have a long way to go. First of all, affordable education is not quite there yet, but we do have more opportunities now. And one of the things that really irked me for a long time was the affirmative action bill. Now, sometimes it's stated that the only reason a person of color gotten a job was because of affirmative action, not that they were qualified. And I've always felt, and my father told me, that you had to be extra better than anyone else to get that job. So that education was a key, and making sure that you don't forget where you come from and always take the opportunity to help someone else.
So where we are today, I mean, education certainly is not as affordable at all for many people and out of the reach for a lot of people. For you, Keanu, what are you looking forward to moving out of high school, and where do you see your life going and your goals?
I'm really excited to go to college. Yes, it's very expensive, but it's also really difficult to pay for it too, but I think there's ways around it. And again, you have to fight really hard to pay for this expensive education. But I think before college, I think that there has to be changes in high school. I think that our education system now is so locked into this one kind of teaching. And I think the issue is that we're not allowed to explore our passions. So I was fortunate enough to go to New Tech, where the students are allowed to explore what they really want to do. So yes, it's really expensive, but I'm excited that I'm getting the opportunity to go and get really good and become an expert in this field, because I have plans to get into politics, run for a Senate position, and I'm actually running for president in 2036. So
you're stating it out there.
Yes.
So I get to be the one that broke your declaration of candidacy.
That is right.
I feel so honored.
Okay. Yeah. So that kind of brings up this point that I really want to push for younger people in this country to get involved in leadership. That can be in politics, business, becoming an advisor, things like that. But when we get younger people involved in leadership, we see this miraculous thing happen where change actually happens, because we have this whole new generation that has all of these ideas and new perspectives on how the country should run and work, that change really does happen. And so, you know, I think that all starts at education. Education needs some definite real reform to get kids involved in what they're passionate about.
So I'm wondering, you know, how far we've come then through just desegregating schools wasn't enough. And then over time, school districts and where people moved and, you know, the schools started to become, in a lot of places in the country and in the South and in the Midwest, have segregated themselves once again because people can't afford to live in the areas with better schools. You know, so I think it's that conundrum of we take a few steps forward and then there's push back. And if education is the key, I also think that there is an important bridge that needs to be made between the younger generation and the older generation. You know, that there has to be learning from the wisdom of those who have been there.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. One of the things I think we can do is there need to be more mentorship programs. Businessmen, doctors, lawyers, all people of stature can be of help. They can, you know, develop mentorship programs and actually screen children, kids, and young adults to go to be a part of it.
So maybe kind of help to direct them in, mm-hmm. in paths that would be well suited for them?
Yes. And why? Because if no one takes an interest in our young people, they'll be left to their own devices, and they won't be socially or, they won't have social awareness, and they won't be any good to society other than a menial job, mm-hmm. and, you know, just to support the economy. But I think education, mentorships, and is the key.
And is there a disconnect? Is there a generational disconnect about what needs to happen? Because mm-hmm. one of the things that you mentioned, Kano, was that you didn't think racism was as big an issue for your generation as socioeconomic inequities.
Mm-hmm. Then see, in my generation, it was more racism than you know, social economic injustice. But that too, my father he sued the state for equal pay for people that were getting government checks, and so if you were of color, your check was significantly lower than a white person's check. So that took about 10 years in the court system back in Georgia, but it eventually passed. So now I see racism is more institutionalized, to where it's you can't get there if you don't know anyone there. So
it's maybe not, especially in a place like the West Coast of California.
Right.
It's more hidden in
right.
the dark shadows.
Mm-hmm. All over the world it is, actually. And that's the thing. You have to be aware of what's all the social issues. You have to have an education. And see, people think education means college. Not necessarily. I think there are a lot of jobs to be had if we had technical vocational type programs. There used to be, but now it's no more.
So we're talking about economic justice in some ways, that if people have access to good education and whatever that education is, to set them up in a way they can support a family and live comfortably, would that be enough for you? I mean, if that's your kind of platform is socioeconomic justice, and for someone like your mom who really struggled to have a better leg up, if that were solved, then is the slate clean? All equality has been met?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I think, yes, socioeconomic issues, if they get solved, yes, that'll be a really big that'll solve a lot of the problems. But I think that, like you said, behind the shadows, there's still this need to judge people, or this need to divide the country based on your skin color. But there shouldn't be. So there's a lot of things that our government can do to solve this issue, because it's not a natural thing. People don't naturally judge someone, and they don't naturally think that they're better than someone just because of their skin color. But I think we base our feelings and our opinions on the things that our leaders say and feel. And so if we change the people that we have leading this country and we still look at them as an example, then eventually this idea of racism can fade away. But before all of that happens, we have to solve all of the little issues that happen in our communities.
So for you, there's a kind of steps up towards the ultimate goal of equality.
That's right.
And so where are we? If you nodded your head around and said, yeah, there's steps up, Have we gone up any steps besides desegregation of schools? Because that's what I keep going back to, is we tried to do something about the Voting Rights Act, because if we're going to change leadership, we have to have equal access to voting for all. But then in 2013, the Supreme Court went back and gutted much of the Voting Rights Act for people in the South, where a lot of the voting bloc that elected our current president came from. So have we made strides that we think we've made if we've, you know, taken apart the Voting Rights Act and gotten back in trouble? I mean, do young people today know how much they are capable of losing?
No, they don't. As a matter of fact, a lot of young people today have no idea of the struggle that has that people of color have had ever since, you know, slavery. And there are people that are totally unaware, because of their socioeconomic background, they are pigeonholed, ghetto or farm, poor farmers and things like that. They don't have access to all the things that they need to be successful in life. And one of the things that America has gone away from is jobs. We used to be a manufacturing country, and now we're more of a service country. All the jobs are elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And see, we made strides in the 70s and 80s when the factories and things were booming, when we produced a lot of goods. A man could go there, raise a family, support his family, buy him a little house, send their first kids to college, and things of that nature. But now they can't do that because there are no jobs. And they always talk about jobs. We're going to hire people. We're going to create jobs. Well, we haven't seen that. And I think that's the key to making all of this social, economical stuff balance out. Because if you make money, you will spend money, and you'll have a better idea of what you want to be and do with your life.
If you're just tuning in, this is my guest Randall Thomas and my other guest Keanu Lede, in talking about strides we've made forward, backwards, sideways in civil rights and towards equality as we move into February, which is Black History Month. It's our annual celebration of achievements by African Americans, and we take this time over the month of February to recognize the central role of Black Americans in U.S. history. And I opened the show talking about my concern that a lot of my college students don't have the breadth of understanding of social justice history. They may know all the dates of the Revolutionary War or the Vietnam War, but they don't seem to know a lot of the social justice story about what happened during the years of the civil rights movement from 1954, Brown versus the Board of Education, to 1968. And so how do we make strides and changes now if we don't even continue to share the stories of people who were able to withstand, I don't know, to have the everyday struggles of life in front of them, but still be a part of something bigger? And I keep thinking of your father, Curtis Thomas, who we talked about, who was part of the civil rights movement. And he was a father, and he had a full-time job, couple jobs, and he was part of the NAACP, kind of his nighttime hobby, and working towards change, and ended up being part of writing the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But do people have the energy today to have their job or their two jobs and be part of the NAACP and work towards social change? Because I hear what you're saying, you know, that those jobs that used to be there to support families, if they're not there and people are struggling with two or three or four jobs just to put food on the table, or like Keanu's mom needing a lot of government assistance, where is the energy to join these movements? And how do we sustain the movements? Because it's not, things don't happen quickly. Does your generation, Keanu, have the patience to start this Take a Knee rally and wait 72 years?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, I think that if we make a few changes, I think we would be able, I don't know, about 72 years. I think that we have the ability to make things move quicker in this generation.
But why? Tell me why you think that.
I think that because now we have access to, we have the ability to send information out in a matter of seconds. So before, you had to wait for the newspaper to get to your house. But now, if you see some injustice happening, all it takes is a quick tweet and thousands of people are reading it around the world. So if we're able to get people involved and spend, even if it's just a little bit of their time during the day, to take part in making real change happen, then that's where your movement and change starts to really happen. Because I think we're, if you're on the phone anyways and accessing social media, send out a tweet that implies that we have an issue here. All it takes is a few seconds.
But that seems like passive activism to me. I mean, you know, being on your phone, that's, I guess, where I go back to. Do you have the resolve? Because what happened the generations before you was they got out the door and on their feet and out to the streets. And we're walking. We had the suffragist movement for 72 years. These women marched and rallied and marched and rallied for decades. And then, you know, through the African-American movements, through the civil rights movements, it was out the door and walking. Like, we might have that. You have this rally coming on Saturday. We had the women's march and, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of women. But will they sustain it for generations? I guess that's my big question is, it's all good in the moment, but once the flurry of the social media passes, will people be able to sustain it?
Yeah, and I think that's where we have to find the right blend of using the technology and access to information that we have and getting people really involved in person. I mean, there's a difference between saying, yeah, I'm there in spirit, and actually saying, yeah, I'm here supporting this movement and I'm using my physical presence to make a statement. The plain answer to your question is, I don't know. I don't know if we have the patience for it. I think that we have to focus on the right now. And I think that we have to really figure out how can we get the younger generation involved now. And I think that goes back to what I was saying. We have to get people involved in leadership. Mm-hmm. If they have access to get to positions where they can actually make change happen in leadership, then yes, we will have the patience.
And so, at 17, what is your vision for your life, let's say 10 years from now? How will you know you're making progress? What will have to be different for you to feel like I'm making progress?
I think that in 10 years, if we're making progress, I'll be able to not say that we're spending billions of dollars on fighting socioeconomic issues and that real change has been made. I think that if we feel the need to spend less time on fighting things, then that's where you know you're making real progress. If we're constantly fighting at this, you know, really high rate, then there's obviously still an issue. But if at some point in 10 years, if we find ourselves less involved, then I think that's a message that maybe there really is progress.
So for you, if there's a reduction in the need for social programs, mm-hmm. then we've leveled the playing field and we've helped lift enough people up.
Yes, that's right.
And so what is your experience with mentors? You know, because Randall brought that up. What kind of mentors do you see in the African-American community for you to look towards?
In the African-American community, I don't really see very much. I've had access to some pretty good connections, congressmen and the leaders of the NAACP, but nobody's ever come to me. And again, I've had to fight to make the connections that I've made, but I don't see progress in widespread access to opportunities like that. And so if it were easier for kids like me to have access to this, then I like that idea of the mentorship programs, but mm-hmm.
Because where would you find a role model right now if you were looking around for guidance? Because you don't want to reinvent the wheel if you've got generations of history behind you who have walked the streets and walked the talk and made change. Where would you go to find someone right now? Who are your role models?
That's the issue. I think my only role model is my mom. That's who I look up to. And I think that I don't think that's okay. I think that we should have access for African American kids like me, there should be more access to mentors and people who have knowledge and people who have experience in the fields that we want to go into.
So why is there the disconnect? You know, why isn't that mentorship there? Because I think about, you know, all these programs in schools where, you know, a lot of white kids have access to people that look like them and counselors and politicians who are in there kind of helping bring these kids along. Why isn't that there?
Well, we have to, first of all, we have to get rid of the color thing.
Okay.
Because once we start splitting and talking about color versus progress, there won't be any progress. You basically have to get rid of the color. You have to get rid of racism. You have to get rid of the second-class citizen syndrome. And, you know, so first of all, we're going to have to love each other and get along with each other. And mentors doesn't have to be of color. They just have to be a mentor. Mm-hmm. And have an interest in the future of the country, to invest some time and energy and money if necessary. So finding the resources, the people that have the resources and the willingness to be a part of Save America, or, you know, and that's what we need to do. We need to be active by being present. Economically and, you know, and emotional support.
So when it comes to something like the Black Lives Matter movement, does that resonate with you then?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Because growing up, a lot of that happened back then. When I was growing up, if you were in the Deep South and you were murdered by, say, someone, they didn't bother to really find out who it was, especially if it was tied to the Ku Klux Klan or some other hate group. It's come along now it's to the point now where the people that are in power have, let's say, allow this to keep happening. Because it shouldn't be, people should not be shot without, you know, shot down in the streets and not even have a weapon. I mean, and it's shoot first, ask questions later. I don't know where that came from.
But that's why I guess I go back to that the idea of mentorships, even if we don't, you know, we don't want to have color be a part of it, and mm-hmm. which is adults should be mentoring children no matter
right.
who they are. I agree with that. But I still feel like that to pass down the history, to pass down, if the kids don't know what it was like back in the day, if the kids don't know what the struggle was, and they only see it through the lens of where they are today, it's hard for them to carry the mantle forward,
right.
to have the same sense of urgency. And it's very difficult to move forward if you're trying to reinvent the wheel.
Right.
Without, so I just, mm-hmm. so I feel like there is some generational connection that needs to be made. To help encourage the next generation, because you have to see someone who looks like you succeeding for you to have a feeling that you can get there. So Keanu, in our last couple minutes, what is it you would want people to know and take away from the rally on Saturday and your experiences?
I think the one big thing is that our communities and other organizations need to allow younger people to speak their truth. I think other adults that are not, not playing a big role in organizations, they have to be willing to listen to what we want to say. And I think for the younger people, we have to have the courage and bravery to stand up and speak about the changes that we want to see. That's the message that I want to get across at the Take a Knee rally. And a lot of the other speakers will be talking about that, but we'll have a lot of topics that we'll be talking about the Take a Knee rally.
I wonder if we need to talk about reducing the voting age to 16 so that we can get kids at a younger age more involved in taking civic responsibility for where we're moving forward.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea, but you pass that, and now we have to make a push to educating people on mm-hmm. how do you pick the right person to get into office?
Right, that civic education needs to come back in.
Exactly.
Because that's what I hear we're talking about, is that we need to understand where we've been. So this Saturday in Mission Plaza is the Take a Knee Rally from 11 to 2:30, sponsored by the San Luis Obispo County NAACP. You're part of the Social Justice League at New Tech High School that's led by your wonderful teacher who accompanied you here today. Thank you, Dara. Keanu, I wish you luck this weekend.
Thank
and I
you
hope
very
it
much.
All goes well. And Randall, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your family
You're
story
welcome.
And your family history. And I hope that this is not the last conversation that we have about this issue. I hope this is a start of bridging generations moving forward.
I hope so.
And this has been a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can contact me through my Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or by email, Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast by joining us at Apple Podcasts. As always, I thank you for being a part of the conversation and for supporting Public Radio KCBX. I look forward to continuing next Tuesday at 2:00.